Good evening. My name is John Berg, and I'm the one of the band of seven who were originally at the LSE and who've been responsible for endowing this more or less annual lecture on the Good Society. Many of you will know the history, but since some of you don't, I hope you'll forgive me if I just very briefly describe it. The origin was in 1948-9, when the seven of us were, as extremely assiduous and students, worked together in informal seminars in preparation for our final examination. And after we'd passed our examinations, we decided to meet annually every year in the same place in which some of our discussions had taken place, namely the Seven Stars around the corner. Having done this, we then met every year, some of us more than that, until in 1989, one of the seminar, Oliver Marston, unfortunately died. And following his death, we wondered how we might commemorate both him and the annual meetings and indicate in some way the debt all of us owed to the LSE for the very important, contented, and instructive years we spent here. And we therefore decided to endow this annual lecture on the Good Society. And we called it a memorial lecture on the Good Society because all of us in those post-war years deeply cared about trying to understand, develop, and contribute to a good society. And the actual format, as it were, of these lectures was drawn up by Alan Milne, himself an academic, and until his untimely death last year, a professor of government and then professor emeritus of politics at Durham University. Well, five of us are now left, and in view of past developments, it occurred to us also that we might not be immortal. And therefore, we're trying to seek some way of perpetuating these lectures. And as a consequence of some preparatory work done by David Bennell, our secretary, he got in touch with the Shapiro Government Society with the thought that we might work together in association and possibly in the future handing over these lectures to them. Perhaps I might say in passing that I'm slightly skeptical about the future because having been head of a college myself, I know how much depends on the enthusiasm and energy of individual students. And one can never be quite certain whether this will be perpetuated subsequently. But if in fact this were to come off, I think it would be a very constructive development. Well, we've had some interesting lectures. We were founded by 1992, as it were, by Ralph Dahrendorf, who gave the first lecture. We then had Mrs. Brunfeld, who was then the Norwegian Prime Minister, and subsequently Bishop Jenkins of Durham, and John Tusser of BBC World Service, and now the Barbican, and last year Melvin Bragg. And this year, we had invited Frank Field to come and talk to us. It was arranged 6 months ago, and he was going to give his lecture on which way welfare. We did not reckon on the three-line whip in the House of Commons or the excessive efficiency of the government whips with a majority of approaching 200, as a consequence of which apparently Frank Field is not permitted to leave the House this afternoon because there's a running whip, and I'm told, on the Greater London Bill. Whether this is anything to do with Ken Livingstone, of course, I wouldn't know. But it is, I think, deplorable that given this long-standing commitment, Frank Field was not allowed to come to us for at least an hour and a half. However, instead, owing to David Bennell's indefatigable efforts, not least ringing around until finally he managed to locate Professor Worcester in the Caribbean. He managed to persuade him, and Professor Worcester very kindly agreed, to give this lecture tonight instead of Frank Field, and we are immensely and profoundly grateful to him. Professor Worcester is a man of quite enormous distinction. He founded the Maury organization. He was its managing director for a whole generation, like 25 years, and still continues to be chairman of Maury and other Maury organizations in different parts of the world. His entry in Who's Who is extremely lengthy, and I don't propose to read it out, but his interests are hugely varied, include not only, of course, politics, where he seems to know virtually everybody, and will continue, I'm sure, to know Frank Field, despite of what has happened this afternoon. He's also very interested in the environment, and we look forward enormously to hearing him talk about the British reluctant Europeans. Professor Worcester.
Thank you, Sir John. I noticed that as you were giving an introduction, that we lost several people from the audience. So I wanted to make it very clear that I'm not Frank Field, but I also want to make it clear that Frank I've seen on two or three occasions over the last 6 months, and he has said how much he is looking forward to giving this talk to the good seminar, and indeed to the Government Shapiro Club, of which I have the honor to be faculty advisor, which is my connection with this lecture. I looked at the brief written by Professor Milne with great interest and thought about the subject and how my chosen topic could be fitted into the theme. And I don't know whether Europe will offer people in Britain the good life. But in this paper, I argue that the United States of Europe isn't here yet, but it's on the way. In this paper, I argue that public opinion is real, it's important, and in the run-up to Maastricht, was mismanaged to the point of neglect. It was also true in relation to the European movement toward the IGC following the Maastricht Treaty ratification process. Its near failure to be adopted, first in Denmark and then France, when these countries sought approval by their electorates of the actions of their governments, give evidence to this. There were lessons to be learned from the interactions between elites and electorates since the foundation of the European community, especially, in my view, in the parallels offered by the extended and elaborate marketing program undertaken, perhaps surprisingly to the you of in the audience, but this is my professional academic background, by the founding fathers of the American Constitution more than 200 years ago, before the word spin doctor was ever invented. The failure of the Conservative government, led by Prime Minister John Major, to lead Britain on the country's move to the heart of Europe is seen, in my view, as a case study in political mismanagement. Prime Minister Tony Blair was also too cautious in his consideration of a referendum on Britain's joining into the single European currency, which he could have won easily in September 1997, in the immediate aftermath of his famous victory. Finally, and in spite of both the EU and Britain's Conservative Party, the indications are that Britain will endorse Amsterdam expansion of the EU, the single European currency, and, as I said at the outset, will be in at the birth of a United States of Europe under another name within the next two decades. Now, when speaking about public opinion, it's most often meant to describe the adult population in a one-person, one-vote model, which would have been unheard of in this country when the LSE was founded just over 100 years ago. Yet Abraham Lincoln not only used the concepts of extended franchise and democratic involvement of the people, by the people, and for the people in the Gettysburg Address, he's also quoted as saying public opinion is everything. I'm convinced, personally, that as a tree falling in the forest makes a noise whether anybody's there to hear it or not, so public opinion exists, perhaps unheard, until someone listens. It seems to me that if I were to ask to define public opinion, it would be simple. Public opinion is the view of a defined population. Thus, as well as the general public, as it's most often described, workers in a factory, of interest to the factory manager, to the trade unions, or civic leaders in the plant community, residents of a local community would be another public. Perhaps people who live in London. Of interest to the politicians, civic leaders, the local media, pressure groups, industrialists thinking of siting a plant there, students of the LSE are a public. I was asked by my colleague in the department, Cheryl Schoenhardt Bailey, 6 years ago, to help her with a survey of American students here at the LSE to determine if there were a vote for them for the presidency, for whom they would vote. That was in advance of a mock election on election day. The students interviewed more people than voted in the election, which then was the true measure of public opinion. At the last general election, we looked at likely voters rather than the adult population because they were of more interest in determining the outcome of the election. And it was the horse race aspect that, of course, was the most journalistic interest. Or young people, or the elderly, or women, or captains of industry, or security analysts, institutional investors, editors, parliamentarians, or any slice of society that can be defined with precision and replicability. I define views, remember my definition, the views of a adult population or students at the LSE or whatever, a defined population. But views I define at three levels, perhaps too poetically for academic adoption, as opinions being the ripples on the surface of the public consciousness, easily blown about by the media or the political winds. Deeper are people's attitudes, the currents below the surface, which are deeper and stronger, and values, the deep tides of the public mood, slow to change, but powerful. Values include belief in God, attitudes to religion generally, views about abortion and the like, things that people don't change, but very seldom, after the age of about 25. Think about it. You'll find yourself, I suspect, nodding in agreement. They're not likely to be changed by media discussion or debate. So where does Europe fall in that three-level assessment of people's views? Witness a moment ago the poll in the Times, I think it was published on Friday, where we showed the sharp decline month on month in Europe, in interest in Europe of people in this country, as the war and defense and Kosovo came shooting up in public opinion, in public concern as an important issue. And yet the National Health Service, education, unemployment changed hardly at all. But Europe declined substantially. This says to me that in the public mood, Europe is not a particularly salient issue. And if I can, let me see if I can get this to wake up and move and work. Cross your fingers. There we are. When we ask, what do you see as the main or other important issues facing Britain today? You see on the black line, quite a jagged line, as publicity has been the focus of attention, or Europe has been the focus of attention, the publicity in the media. Can you see the chart over here? It's going to be awkward if you can. Now, finally, in the section on public opinion, let me just quote from Epictetus, who lived in the first century AD, who said that perceptions are truth because people believe them. Now, what are the issues facing Europe today? Single currency, a central bank, federalism versus subsidiarity, the relationship between parliament and the executive, judicial review, balance of power between larger and smaller states, sovereignty. What is this parallel? The place, America, the time, 1783 to 1803. The parallels between the emerging American governmental structure during the period of Confederation, 1781 to 1798, and its aftermath and the forging of the United States of America and the period in which we are living under today are remarkable. Many of the economic and political issues current in America then are current now in Europe. A floating and weak legislature. Then the Confederate Congress met in Philadelphia, Princeton, Trenton, and New York. Now the European Parliament's caravan moves on between Strasbourg and Brussels. Then the legislators complained of toothlessness, as they do now. So what happened at the Miracle of Philadelphia in 1787? The drafting of the Constitution of the United States, giving much more power to the central government, but reserving the rights not granted in the Constitution to the individual states, the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, otherwise known today as subsidiarity. When Lord Cornwallis surrendered to the colonial and French forces at Yorktown in 1781, the War of Independence was effectively over, although it took two more years to get the actual peace treaty signed in 1783. During that period, a weak, powerless, and broke Congress met at the sufferance of the 13 colonial states in Philadelphia, but they had no money to pay troops and the merchants who'd financed the war on the promise of eventual repayment. Acting under the deliberately weak Articles of Confederation first drafted in 1776, the Continental Congress met in a talking shop without powers of taxation, sovereignty, or even much influence. Sounds like the European Parliament today. Who now remembers who it was that drafted their Constitution? Anybody here? A man named John Dickinson. Led their deliberations. Charles Thompson was Secretary of the First Continental Congress and served for a time as its president. Bless you. Their powers, only those delegated to the states. Their control to the state legislatures, not as still in Great Britain to the people. Their site of meetings, their date of ratification, March 1781, and the religion during the Confederation period, the Anglican Church was disestablished. There were a number of other parallels. Each state had its own flag, its currency, its system of taxation, laws of slavery and property rights, legislature, customs, and alliances and enmities. Georgia and Virginia were the largest southern states. New York and Massachusetts, the largest in the north, each had their followers, but they were also feared for their power and influence. So what happened in that period was very similar to what's been happening in Europe over the past few years leading up to Maastricht. The European nation states have reserved the power to tax, to legislate, to represent themselves in war and peace with other nations, to opt into alliances and opt out, to call for and exercise minority rule, and to cast vetoes. It wasn't until the Supreme Court Chief Justice John Marshall of Virginia, in the case of Marbury versus Madison in 1803, determined that the court would exercise judicial review over the acts of Congress of the United States to determine whether acts passed by the Congress were in accord or in violation of the Constitution of the United States, that the powers of the three pillars of the executive, judicial, government, and legislative government were in place. Then all executive and legislative powers came within the purview of the courts. Much more stealthily, the power of the European Court of Justice has been growing in Europe. Until now, it is estimated that more than half of the British Parliament's acts are now subject to European judicial review. But how was it sold? By a few well-organized, dedicated men. Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay, authors of the Federalist Papers. Polemics of a high standard, yet closely reasoned, fiercely argued, widely discussed over some years, topic by topic, treating the electors, admittedly a tiny proportion of the public, yet many unlettered, uneducated by modern standards, without the facilities of modern communication, transportation, infrastructure, political parties, perhaps a blessing, or pressure groups, except as they evolved during the debates. Majority voting wasn't on the agenda. It was all or nothing. Every one of the 13 states had to cede power to the center. Every one had to give up perquisites of office. Some, Virginia and Maryland, land for the federal capital. Some funding, and all had to give up some sovereignty. Without the Federalist Papers, it would have not happened. Without careful political manipulation, it would not have happened. Without a figurehead of stature on whom all could agree, a military hero, a rich patrician plantation owner, George Washington, it would not have happened. Now contrast this to the Maastricht Treaty. Complex, obtuse, in parts unreadable, at least by Ken Clark, with little thought for how it would play in Peoria, and apparently no consideration for the adoption process to ensure its passage, ignoring its impact on public opinion. Certainly no one who was aware of the Eurobarometer findings or who'd read my article in the European Business Journal in 1989 would have chosen Denmark, even more reluctant Europeans than the out-of-step British in which to test the water. No wonder the first referendum result was a defeat for the Danish government and for the managers of Maastricht. The selling of Maastricht was tracked as it went by the European Commission's regular opinion poll, the Eurobarometer. It and other polls showed widespread support for the community generally and for Maastricht specifically, but during the contest showed support for Maastricht losing ground across the community. With most of the fieldwork for the final barometer during the process taking place after Black Wednesday, it was likely that the currency chaos in the markets of the September 16th realignment will have been the main cause for the sharp drop in support for Maastricht. When you look at the British attitudes towards being in Europe, you can see it's a pretty mixed picture. We voted in 19, I say we, having co-authored a book called We British. I hope you'll forgive me for adoption of the title. My colleagues told me I'd be taken before the courts for the breach of the Trades Description Act, but so far it hasn't happened. You'll recall that in 1975, Mr. Wilson, Mr. Callahan took us to a referendum, and we voted at that time 67-33. Interestingly, 59-41 in Scotland to stay in the EEC as it was then known. By 1977, it was marginal, 53-47. By 1980, following the beginning of the deindustrialization of Britain under Margaret Thatcher, then the least popular prime minister in British history, 71% said if there were a referendum now on whether Britain should stay in or get out of the European Common Market, as it was called, how would you vote? And 71% said out, and only 29% said in. By 1990, that had reversed to 69-31, which was its most popular level. And then, as you can see, it got narrower and narrower until today, well, a few months ago, just at the end of last year, 54% said they would stay in, but 46% said they would get out. The cultural identity of the British is antipathetic to Europe, with only about a quarter of the British feeling European, a third, saying they feel European, whereas three quarters say they feel they belong strongly to the local community. 84% believe they feel strongly to, respectively, England, Scotland, or Wales. And 78%, just over three quarters, say they believe they feel strongly that they believe they belong to Great Britain. Only 35% of the British say, in a study we did for the Institute of Citizenship, sponsored by the National Westminster Bank, that they feel European. Henley Center's Planning for Consumer Change program found that while 48% of Italians, 41% of Germans, and 30% of the French said they felt as European as they did a citizen of their own country, this was only true of 12% of the British. Now, over the past year or so, measures of British attitudes to Britain joining the single European currency have been very negative. Most recently, in March, the data that I have, 56% said if there were a referendum now on whether Britain should be part of a single European currency, that they would vote against, and 31% said they would vote in favor. However, when a second question is put, if the government were to strongly urge that Britain should be a part of a single European currency, how would you vote? Then there's a swing of about 5% more favorable. And the reality is that when a referendum is called, the government would indeed urge Britain's electors to vote to join, as happened in 1975 in Britain and over Maastricht in Denmark. Voters here will be swayed by this action. Now, in Morey polling originally for the European Movement and then updated for the Times, we offered a respondent a choice of four attitude statements. I strongly support Britain's participation. I strongly oppose Britain's participation. Or the balance, I am generally in favor of British participation, but could be persuaded against it if I thought it were good for the British economy. And I am generally opposed to Britain's participation, but could be persuaded in favor of it if I thought it was good for the British economy. And the light green and the light red or pink figures together represent 50% of the British public. Therefore, conclusion, a low salience opinion being held that can be influenced by the winds of the media and the political statements. My own view is that the British public, not very interested in Europe, will pause when it comes time to vote in a referendum on a single European currency, and they will look at the big beasts of the Conservative Party, Ken Clark and Michael Heseltine, in opposition to the party hierarchy, strongly urging that Britain support it. They will look at a united, in-line Labour Party under Tony Blair. They will look at a uniform Liberal Democratic Party, and they will say, they're for it. And they will look at the men with staring eyes, as we knew them in 1975, including Theresa Gorman, and they will say, I know which of the two groups I trust. I don't know a lot about single European currency. I don't know a lot about central European banks. I don't know a lot about all this, but I think I know whose side I'm on. And Morey found, let me just go into a bit of demography and segmentation on this question, just to show that if you take the 53-29 position as it was in November, that you can see that that 24 points becomes 13-point negative in the 25 to 34-year-old, but above 55 reaches a negative 36%, 35 and 37. And if you look at the switch between the two, you can see that overall there's a 5% swing, but there's a 9.5% swing to young people if the government were to strongly urge that Britain should be a part, and only 3.5% of the over 65s. I won't skip those. Just to say that the media, it's very interesting. You can see that despite the skepticism of the editor of the Times, Peter Stoddard, and the Times management, that of Times readers, 48% say they would vote in favor of a single European currency. You have seen the Telegraph position. There's only a 9-point deficit in the Telegraph. The people who are really against it are the Sun readers, the Express readers, the Mail, the Star, and the Mirror. And on Sundays, the same. The people who are much against it are the People, News of the World, Mail on Sunday, and surprisingly, the Independent on Sunday. Now, we're about to have, in a month's time, a Europarliamentary voting. How would you vote if there were a general election tomorrow? We measured for the Green Party in the 12th to the 16th of February. 27% said they'd vote Tory, 54% said they'd vote Labour, and 13% said they would vote for the Liberal Democrats. We ask a second question. How do you intend to vote at the European parliamentary elections on the 10th of June? And we found 26% down 1 for the Tories, 52% down 2, and the Liberal Democrats coming up 2. But when we said, how likely are you to get along to vote in the European parliamentary election, only 22% said certain and 17% very likely. Now, 38% was the turnout of the last European parliamentary elections 4 years ago. And we would guess from these figures that 39%, combining the certains and very likelies, will be a likely figure this time. So we're certainly not going to see a big turnout. Now, a year or two ago, there were Eurosceptic Scandinavians. I mentioned earlier that the Danes were even more reluctant at the time of Maastricht. And yet, there was this big swing around after the beginning of the year. They were published in January by Gallup. And in Denmark, from a negative, or from more in opposition than in favor, it swung from 50% in favor and 38% opposed. In Sweden, 50-31. Now, Butler and Rani, in 1978, inform us about referendums. Referendums are widely used, too widely for my taste, in some European countries, and certainly in the United States, in some states. They should not be confused with opinion polls, but they often are. Their response rate is not as high, and they are, for the electorate and the actors, the culmination of an election process that speaks to a certain proposition, have proponents and opponents, are argued in the media, and conclude on a day certain with the end game of a balloting process under the provenance of the state. People treat them differently, with good reason, for the responsibility of the result is theirs, in a way not so in opinion polls. Thus, when the British government, under the then Prime Minister, Harold Wilson, gave in to the problems facing his party to provide the British people the opportunity to vote on whether or not to stay in or get out of Europe in June 75, the British people, with greater or lesser enthusiasm, took part in the referendum campaign, which was concluded, with a definitive outcome that Britain was in and in to stay. Even the most ardent opponents of Maastricht, when arguing for a referendum on that ill-fated treaty, drew back for the most part in proposing Britain's exit from the European community, for that argument had been well and truly lost by the vote of 67% to 33% by the vote of the British people. My own position on referendums is they don't belong in a well-managed democratic society with a representative form of government as in Great Britain, except on the subject of constitutionality and where the loss of sovereignty of the public's concern. none on hanging, in my view, none on limiting public spending, or on the many issues that plague the California ballot papers and reduce participation in Switzerland. Yet the view of the British public on wishing to have their say is quite clear, as we found in our survey, repeated surveys, for the Joseph Rowntree Reform Trust. More than three people in four, 77% of the British, favor referendums being obligatory on Parliament on the petition of, say, a million electors. And the Labour government has been listening. Has been so clearly seen these past years, the Conservative government's political elite in Britain lost touch with its people. It's suffering the consequences. It's in the cold and is there to stay for some years to come. For several years, principal Conservative government spokesmen, the Prime Minister, the Chancellor, and the Foreign Secretary, argued down any suggestion that the people should have a say on anything, even a single currency. Only after several years was that reversed, and only then, with the reluctant conversion of the Chancellor, Ken Clark, putting up barriers to the excuse exercise that will now never take place under a Conservative government. If they'd held one on Maastricht, in my view, they could not have lost it, and would have isolated the Eurosceptics who have done so much damage to the image of the Conservative government. With all three parties on one side, it would have been a replay of 1975, and they would not have lost the last general election by so wide a margin. Europe was not an issue, it was an image issue. It was an image issue because it was splitting the Conservative Party. I'm so sorry. Thank you very much. There's nothing I can do about it. It's controlled from up there, but I can certainly turn up my vocal cords. Yes, and I am coming to a conclusion in any case. I wish you'd spoken up earlier, sir. The conclusion, really, is the inevitability as seen by the British people. It's all very well to find that 56% say that they would vote against a referendum if they had the opportunity to do so, and only 31% say they would. But if you follow that question, do you think that in 10 years' time, Britain will or will not have joined the single European currency, then 8 people in 10 say they expect that it will. They might not like it, but they think it inevitable. Now, in just a coda, the British business view is that about 1 in 4 senior businessmen in Britain are in favor of joining the euro as soon as possible, and 37% joining the euro after the next general election. So you can see that 6 in 10 of British business are in favor of Britain joining the euro, and only 1 in 4 are against it. Captains of industry have been moving in favor since we first measured in 1996, when 50% were in agreement and 32% in disagreement with the principle of Britain's participating in a single currency. It moved in 97 to 67-28 and moved last year to 72-21. When you look at city analysts and ask them thinking about European Union's business environment as a whole, what impact do you expect the introduction of the euro to have in the short term or medium term or long term, you see that even in the short term, the people who watch the money, the pension fund managers and the like, believe that joining the euro will have a positive impact on Britain's economy. In the medium term, it becomes an overwhelming 64-8, and in the long term, 73% to 2%. I believe those figures are fairly persuasive. Now, the British might not prefer it, but as I say, they see it as inevitable. While only a third expect to see a United States of Europe by the year 2010, a different question, over half, 57%, expect a United States of Europe by 2050. And public opinion is moving in that direction faster than we know. While only 17% of the British said they supported a United States of Europe with a federal government in 1994, and 18% in 1998, no change, omitting the fatal words federal government almost doubled support to 34% in a survey that we published in 1997. My conclusion then is that I'm not sure whether it will provide the people of Great Britain with a better life, with a better society, with a good society, because it might not be here yet, but a United States of Europe under some name is on the way. Thank you very much.
Professor Worcester very kindly agreed to answer questions. And so may I invite the first one, please? And I think somebody's supposed to be here with a microphone. Would you please wait before the microphone reaches you? Would you kindly say who you are?
My name is Richard Hall, a member of the public. I find it quite disturbing that on these matters there's such a considerable difference between what people think will happen and what they wish to happen. And I, in fact, another interesting case was in Scottish independence, where a majority of Scots thought it would happen, but only a minority wanted it to happen. It doesn't that worry you that, in effect, people are presumably a very substantial minority, presumably at least believe, as it were, their views will be disregarded?
I do think that's an excellent question and gets to the heart of the dilemma that I have measuring and interpreting British public opinion. And it has to do, I think, as much as anything with the feeling of helplessness and hopelessness that the British public have had over these last 30 years that I have lived and worked in this country and studied British public opinion. You lived through a period of some 17 years when I would have a letter from Douglas Hurd in response to an argument that I was making that they should have a referendum on Maastricht, saying that's not the way we do things in this country. And I wrote back and said, don't be ridiculous. I was advising Harold Wilson and Jim Callaghan in 75. They damn well do it if it suits their convenience. Now, this is the only democratic country, major country in the world, where the sovereignty does not rest with the people. And we're living now under a government that talked about bills of rights, about constitutional reform, about a written constitution, about a Freedom of Information Act in opposition, and these things have somehow gone missing in government. And in my own view, personal expression, forgive me as an alien, a foreigner, for making it, but perhaps after 30 years here you would excuse me for the opportunity to respond to your excellent question. This government should find that the people of this country are fed up with top-down government, and it's about time for a bit more bottom-up government and listening to what the people say. Now, having said that, I wanted just to add that we were lucky enough to win the contract under competitive tender for a thing called the People's Panel, and this is being done for the Cabinet Office and for the government as a whole. And much to my astonishment, ministers have overruled civil servants and have said that it will all in its entirety be published. Now, this is like our friend Douglas Wass leaving his post as a permanent secretary at the Treasury and joining the board of the Freedom of Information Society. I found that ironic in the extreme, because information has not been available heretofore in this country by any stretch of the imagination. Until we get a Freedom of Information Act, it ain't going to be.
Thank you very much.
Charles Regan, you gave us some figures towards the end about the views of British business. Huh? It's often been said in recent months and years that the various surveys that have been conducted of British business opinion have tended to concentrate on the opinions of big business and big firms and the people in large organizations, rather than smaller businesses, which are in numerically, although not in terms of employment, are the great majority. Is that in fact correct, or what did your figures, the ones that you showed us, in fact represent in terms of the cross-section, as it were, of British business?
I was asked to conduct two surveys of be two surveys separate, one comparable to the first one we did to measure change of 10 or more employees, and a second parallel survey with the less than 10 employees. Now, even Adair Turner, the Director General of the CBI, will acknowledge that the views of people in the smallest businesses, fewer than 10 employees, are against a single European currency. And I think if we have those two sets of figures side by side, people can make up their own mind as to whether or not they wish to define businesses. But what happened, just one more sentence on that, what happened when ICM did a survey for the Business in Stirling group and went down to all employees, was that if you were, let's say, the chairman of ICI, your answers were, and let me put it another way, if you, sir, were the chairman of ICI and I had three employees in a woodworking shop, my vote counted 139 times the weight of your vote on a one-man, one-vote basis. Now, that, in my view, can't be right.
It's Simon Jaffe. I wanted to go back to the issue of perception and reality. We know there are many examples from history of when a policy has been supported by the majority of the population and the subsequent events have not turned out in the way that were forecast. For example, when Britain came out of the ERM, business confidence slumped, despite the fact that interest rates came down and the exchange rate depreciated. In other words, ideal conditions for an economic recovery. In a similar fashion, when Churchill took Britain back to the gold standard in 1925, the vast majority of the population and indeed economic commentators thought it was the right thing to do. I believe that Keynes was the only person who voiced any opposition, and even he agreed in the end that Britain should go back, but that sterling was overvalued by around 10%. Similarly, in 1931, when Britain came off gold, people again thought it would be a disaster, and people looked to other countries, for example, France, that stayed on gold, and they thought that France would experience far better conditions for economic recovery than Britain. I just wondered if you could perhaps comment on that.
Favor, and other people
Thank you. Professor Worcester, one small correction, if I may. I believe the name of the Director General of the CBI, is Adrian Turner, not Anthea.
No, Adair Turner.
Adair?
Yeah.
Right. Adair. I thought you said Anthea.
No. Adair. Sorry. A-D-A-I-R.
Right. My question is, Leslie Palmier. My question is, what influence do you think opinion polls, yours and others, have had on government over the period you've been observing?
Well, I think all we have to do, I'll give you two quick answers to that. One is the spectacle of the President of the United States being held up through his immorality and travail, resulting travail, by Hillary holding one hand and American public opinion holding the other. And I just found it remarkable, and indeed the week of the tapes was on radio and television 14 times trying to explain what was going on in the United States of America. And I was scratching my head pretty vigorously until I heard Governor Cuomo, former governor of New York, quoted as saying, of course I would trust him with the government, I just wouldn't trust him with my sister. And I figured out what was going on. I think the American public were very clear about it. But I'm taken back only 37 days, to the Sunday following the initial bombing in Kosovo. And on the basis of a telephone phone-in, I call them voodoo polls, 84% of whom, in a phone-in poll to talk radio, said they were opposed to Britain's being involved in the bombing of Kosovo, of the NATO planes. And that day, three opinion polls, one of which was my own in the Mail on Sunday, but also a poll in the Sunday Times, and a third one, I'm not sure where it was, may have been the Observer, showed that around 6 in 10 of the British were in favor of the bombing of Kosovo. Now, there's no question in my mind that the President and the Prime Minister have been strengthened in their resolve by knowing that they're going with the grain of public opinion on the question of the NATO engagement. And they're reluctant to commit ground troops, and indeed very early on painted themselves into a corner saying that they would not commit ground troops. And then they saw public opinion fairly mixed on it. And I think they read the runes wrong, as indeed I wrote in the New Statesman, and I think it was early November 1997, that the Prime Minister and the Chancellor, never mind the leader of the opposition, are seriously misreading the runes of public opinion over Maastricht, over the single European currency, that he can win it any time he wants. What this country is looking for in this instance, as I've suggested here, is leadership, not waiting until the polls swing in your favor.
John Murphy, LSE Class of 58. If, or possibly when, the British public is persuaded that the pound can no longer stand on its own and were to be given a choice between the euro and the dollar, which way do you feel they'd go and why?
Thank you. I believe I've thought about that a fair bit. I'm president of a chairman of a thing called the Pilgrim Society, which is the London-based organization which stands in furtherance of Anglo-American relations. And I'd like to say the dollar, but frankly, I don't think either the United States or Europe will give Britain the choice. And getting back to the earlier question, I think it will be, there is no alternative, and Britain's role will be to take part in the single European currency. And I believe that the American government, certainly this government, and I suspect the next one as well, believes that they would rather have Britain as a stable influence in a single European currency and central European bank as a partner here than as a partner there. In other words, American foreign policy will be best, and monetary policy will be best served by Britain being in the euro rather than being a a very small tail on a very large dollar dog.
My name is Donald Brown. As you can probably see, I'm in the older age group. I would certainly like to challenge your analogy between the United States, or as they were then, the separate states of America, and in the 18th century, and this country in the 20th century, coming into the 21st. We've had experience of governing ourselves. We've had recent experience of being isolated in a very savage war, and we know very well how we managed those two situations. And I personally have the strongest objection to going into a single currency, because it would increase majority voting in the whole area of government which is so vital to us. And we've already seen just this year how the cultures, the political cultures in other countries in the European Union are so very different from our own. And I hope the country really thinks about this question, because if they do, they will see how inadvisable it would be to put ourselves at the mercy of majority voting where there are such huge differences in political culture. And I make my case on that.
Thank you. Following that question, you talked about opinions, attitudes, and values. Right. Is that better? Right. You talked about opinions, attitudes, and values. Well, I think that we emphasize too much the differences that exist between the British and the Continentals. And I think it is very important that we emphasize the values that we have in common. Now, is this possible? And can this be measured? And what do you think?
Hello. Two questions, really, Professor Worcester. Mark Hoder. I'm just wondering, firstly, do you think there's a great deal of variation in public opinion in Britain on the basis of whether groups who benefit from EU funds benefit, so i.e. farmers, for example, who benefit from CAP funds, are they more supportive than the average across the rest of the country? And secondly, assuming that polls showing that utilitarian and instrumentalist support for the EU is quite high, are there any measures you think that the EU can take to maybe secure more effective, deeper loyalty?
Thank you. The variation point is well taken, and I've long since observed, both in the 1989 article and in the 1997, I think it was, article in the European Journal, how there's a remarkable correlation between the gives and the gets in terms of national support, with the Irish, the Portuguese, the Greeks, the Spanish being extremely strong Europeans in support of virtually everything to do with Europe, and the Germans being about the same level as the British, with the Scandinavians being the most reluctant of Europeans. And funny, there's a remarkable convergence between the give nations and the get nations and their correlation or dismay on that. There are actions that the European Union can take. Transparency is certainly one of them. Equality in employment is certainly another. They are trying to take steps at the moment to recruit more British subjects to European posts. There is a cultural difference between the European Parliament and the way they're treated, and particularly with the curious way they have of paying MEPs and subsidizing MEPs with what the British would regard as lavish facilities and staff support and the like. Although we did hear at the Government Shapiro Club from James Spence, a senior civil servant in the European Parliament, that there were more employees in, there were more employees, where was it, Christian? There were more employees in a fairly small department of the British government than there were in the entire European Parliament. Was it Heritage? Yeah, more staff in the Department of Heritage than there were in the entire European Parliament, European Commission.
Anybody else like to ask a question? Right.
Alan Hickman, physician. You mentioned the original 13 American states when talking about America's experience, and that they all had their individual currencies. What happened to their currencies, and what was the effect of them being unified?
I'm not an expert on that aspect. I'm more a political scientist than economist, but several things did happen. There was an unholy war over whether or not there would be the equivalent of a single European bank. The first bank of the United States was a hotly disputed topic between Hamilton and Jefferson, particularly, Hamilton being in favor of the central currency and a strong currency and a strong central decision-making power over taxation and interest rates and the like, and Jefferson being a states' writer. The impact was, as you'd expect, a movement of labor as much as could be, but the blacks, being slaves, couldn't move except on the Underground Railway later, and the agrarian society was supported by the gift of free land so people could farm, and of course the vast majority of people were farmers, so they didn't tend to move. They were just poor farmers, particularly in places like West Virginia, which split off, which was subsequent to the 13 states. But there was a great disparity between the wealth of the Massachusetts based on trade and Virginia based on slavery and agriculture.
It's very unfortunate that because of the circumstances we could not give more notice of your lecture, because if we had, I'm sure the audience would have been very much larger, because it has been absolutely fascinating, and it really is a great pity that more people were not here to hear what you had to say. Some of the responsibility, of course, rests with the director of the LSE, who decided to inform a no doubt avid population about the meaning of the third way this evening, a long time after we had decided that this lecture was going to be tonight. So for two reasons, there are fewer people here now than should have been
to appreciate what you had to say.
Wait until his salary comes up before the governor's.
I think Professor Worcester and I will be hand in hand on that particular issue. Well, thank you very much indeed for joining us. It's been particularly interesting to hear the view of somebody who works both as a practitioner in this field and at the same time as an academic. It's a very, very interesting combination, and I think we all benefited very much from this. Thank you very much, and may I say there's a reception upstairs if you would like to join us. Thank you.